Last case on the court's oral calendar this morning is Eisenhower versus Eisenhower. Please approach. So we'll be having oral argument on behalf of appellant this morning only, no brief filed by respondent. Would you please approach the podium, introduce yourself for the record, and provide your argument?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Aaron Roy, and I represent the appellant, Jeffrey Eisenhower, in this matter. I am here today because there was a gross miscarriage of justice when the district court issued an order for protection for 10 years against Mr. Eisenhower in clear conflict with the statute and due in part to a conflict of interest of the judicial officer that issued it. This judge's rewriting of the law was a violation of Mr. Eisenhower's due process rights. Orders for protection, while not criminal, do infringe on the rights of the respondent in the case. They limit their free speech, they limit their ability to be in certain locations, and they subject them to criminal liability. Because of this, respondents are entitled to due process. Mr. Eisenhower did not receive the due process that he was entitled to under the standard. In the court's erroneous decision, the court clearly and explicitly relied on statute 518B.01, subdivision 6A, which is a lower standard because the statute is entitled subsequent orders and extensions. The statute reads, the court may extend the relief granted in an existing order for protection or if a petitioner's order for protection is no longer in effect. It does not read.
Can I ask you, what would be your best argument if we had a brief from the respondent who had claimed to us that it was harmless error because there's no dispute that the criminal sexual assault had occurred, and your client, in other words, didn't deny that, and that's listed as a basis for granting an order for protection.
Yes, Your Honor. And so if we were to be addressing that argument, I am familiar with the case Thompson v. Schirmacher, I believe it's pronounced. It's 906 Northwest 2D 945, which did rule that past acts of domestic abuse can be considered when granting an order for protection. However, that case is more nuanced than what I believe a respondent or the petitioner in this case would have argued or the court believed. That case does allow for those past acts to be introduced, but is factually different and is more nuanced and relies on the court's discretion. In that case, the court stated that because the concerns were brought up that if the court were to allow past acts of domestic abuse, that it would open the floodgates, that any person who had ever been a victim of domestic assault could get at any time down the road an order for protection. And the court addressed that concern and said this is not what they were ordering. Instead, that they were ordering that the judge could consider it but still gets to use their discretion, and they still have to rely on other factors, including the likelihood for future abuse. In this case, the act of abuse was so distant and so remote, over a decade old, there had been no contact, no violations of the DANCO, none of that had happened in that time, that there was no likelihood of future abuse. In fact, what happened in this case was Mr. Eisenhower went to a restaurant he didn't know the petitioner worked at. He sat down, he ordered a drink. There's some debate over what happened, but the judge does make findings that there was no physical abuse, there was no harassment by Mr. Eisenhower.
Or intent on his part to go there.
Correct. There was no intent. And so the court then has the discretion to consider the past abuse, but also has to consider these other factors. And we believe the court's findings don't support this legal conclusion of harmless error. Additionally, the judge did issue the order for 10 years when the petitioner was only asking for a 2-year order. Typically under the statute for a new order for protection, the limit is 2 years on that order. The extensions give the court more leeway in granting it for extended periods of time, and that's what the court did.
Let me ask you this. If we agree with you and we reverse, why shouldn't we remand?
And I think the court has the ability to do both, but I believe that the record here is pretty thorough in establishing that not only was the law applied wrong and a conflict of interest exists, but the record is pretty thorough that there was no intent to harass, that there was no, that these acts of abuse were so distant that there is no need for a current order for protection.
Is there anything that prevents Ms. Eisenhower from petitioning for an order for protection if we were to simply reverse without any remand?
There's nothing that would prevent her from petitioning again. I think that she has that ability to, and then it could be relitigated if Mr. Eisenhower chose to contest it again. Going back to the statute, the statute's very clear that it has to be a previous or existing order for protection. It doesn't say civil no contact agreement, doesn't say harassment restraining order, and it certainly doesn't say domestic abuse no contact order. And that's extremely important in this case because domestic abuse no contact orders are issued often sua sponte by the court or as conditions of release in a criminal case. The respondent or the restricted party is not entitled to an evidentiary hearing. They're not entitled to present evidence, call witnesses, those types of matters. And so subdivision 6A allows for this lower standard because it's assumed that the respondent's due process rights had previously been granted to them. And then it allows for this lower standard. Here that did not happen, and there's, under the plain reading of the statute, a Danko cannot apply in this case because those due process rights have not been fulfilled. Moving on to the judge's conflict of interest, as a reminder to the court, the conflict was only discovered after the judge's ruling, and it was discovered that Groshek Law, the attorney for the appellant in this case, represented Judge Yellowhammer, the district court judge's, her son's soon-to-be ex-wife, so her soon-to-be ex-daughter-in-law, in an ongoing dissolution of marriage that involved custody of her grandchildren, that involved division of property and assets at the time.
Let me ask you this. If we reverse and don't remand, do we need to reach this issue?
Your Honor, I think the court has the ability to, but if the court does not, if the court reverses and does not remand, I don't think it's necessary. But as I stated previously, I think the record is sufficient enough to reverse it. But I do think this is an important point in the event that the court does remand, because this will need to go in front of a neutral decision maker.
If this court were to reverse, do you think our decision should be designated as precedential?
I do, Your Honor. I think that this is a case of first impression for this court, whether or not a Danko or any other type of no contact order qualifies as a previous order under 518B01 subdivision 6A. And I think that the language of the law is very clear. I think the plain meaning is extremely clear, and there's no need to read into the intent, but I think it's important that this isn't allowed to happen in the future, being that it was such an outrageous decision, quite frankly, an incorrect reading of the law.
Do you have any idea how often this happens? Just empirically, I realize it's not in the record, but
you know, Your Honor, I don't. We asked the court for any kind of authority at the time when they were making the oral ruling. The court was not able to provide any, and then in preparing for this case, we weren't able to find a case that said a Danko is akin, as the judge put it, to an order for protection for this. And so this is, I believe, a case of first impression, and that's why I believe that it should be a precedential opinion.
Well, there is some case law that talks about looking to, when you're dealing with an HRO or an OFP, you can kind of look to the case law for one or another for guidance, but I mean, arguably that's a different situation, because in both of those situations, you have the right to notice, an opportunity to be heard, an opportunity to present evidence, challenge the evidence against you, and it's my recollection that you don't get any of that with the Danko. The court just issues it.
That is correct, Your Honor. It's a sua sponte decision. There's no due process rights involved in that.
Mr. Rohrer, can I just clarify, and I understand your point about due process, but would the best direct answer be it's not referenced in the domestic abuse statute?
I'm sorry, can you clarify what's not referenced?
The Danko. In other words, when extends an order, wouldn't the direct answer before we can get to the constitutional issue really be it's not authorized by this special statutory basis for a domestic abuse order?
Absolutely. It's not included in the statute. The plain reading of the statute says only previous orders for protection.
Thank you.
Yes. If the court would like, I could continue with the issues of the court's conflict of interest. I know we had addressed the fact of if the court is to reverse that, we won't have to get to that issue. But if the court has questions, I'd be happy to address them. Otherwise, I'd be happy to continue to address the conflict of interest.
I don't see any questions regarding the conflict of interest.
Okay. And last, I would refer to the question of harmless error under the Thompson case to note that not only is the record here different than the Thompson case and that the court is allowed to consider these, but it's a more nuanced decision. The facts of Thompson are so different from this case in that in Thompson, what happened was the petitioner was a mother petitioning on behalf of herself and her minor child against the father of the child. Abuse happened somewhere between 2 and 3 years earlier, and the order for protection came as a result of the father successfully petitioning for joint custody of the child. So the mother knew that harm could come because the father was entitled to contact with the child. The father was entitled to contact with her, most likely, when exchanging the child. And so there was a reasonable fear of imminent harm to both her and the child. And the abuse in that case was much more recent. Here, the abuse was so distant, and there had been no indications that any abuse or any intentional contact could ever or would ever happen again. And so in that case, the court found that it was relevant past abuse and that there was a need for an order for protection. Here, there's no indication that this contact would ever happen again, that any abusive contact would ever happen. And because of that, the Thompson decision does not make this a harmless error case and that the decision should be reversed. And if remanded to the court would have to consider Thompson and the other factors included with it and then make a decision at most for a 2-year order for protection rather than the court issuing a 10-year order when the petitioner was only requesting 2.
I don't see any other questions. We thank you for your argument, your appearance today, and you'll have our decision promptly.
Thank you very much.
That concludes the oral calendar this morning.